introduction to this idea of the growth of immigration detention outside the United States. I'm mostly going to talk about Europe. Many of you are aware that Australia has had a very robust immigration detention program, much like ours, has grown dramatically in the last 15 years, although with the they're in a similar spot. The reason I mention Australia right off the bat is because I don't have any slides about them, and I'm not going to discuss them too much, but they're a big system. They're like ours. They have a recently elected Labor government. They're undergoing a real soul-searching process right now as far as how they deal with immigration detention. The area I'm going to discuss very briefly, just for a few minutes, because I want to get into our bigger discussion, is the changes in Europe, which I think are really set to bring to radically increase the number of people who are detained across all the EU partner countries. So, no relationships to disclose. Basically, I just want to point out the blue countries here. So these are countries that receive immigrants. There are many places outside of Europe, outside the developed world, where there are lots of immigrants. Obviously, people are probably very familiar with, like for instance, South Africa receiving refugees from Zimbabwe. But I'm going to focus in mostly on Europe. So this very busy slide, I just want you to look at the narrow blue piece of the pie. That narrow blue piece of the pie for each of these areas is what percentage of the whole population are immigrants. And so if you look at ours, that blue piece of the pie is about 10% of the population. These are from 2005, so this may, you know, this has changed a little bit. But if you look at Europe, all of Europe, you see that it's 8%. If you look down at Australia, it's very high, it's 15%. So it gives you a sense of the number of people who have come into that country or that region. This is a map of European immigration detention centers. This map actually, if I put up nobody has a current map, but a current map would basically obliterate the whole country because this is in 2005, so there are probably twice this many detention centers around Europe right now. So just briefly, you know, international law, so there are many different international law mechanisms, and I'm not going to discuss international law specifically, but there's a presumption that if you come into a country from another country, we, as the United States and also European countries, are signatories to international law documents that say that there should be a presumption that you won't be detained. Now, you remember this is kind of in high relief against our changes here in 1996 in the United States, that people should have the ability to apply for refugee asylum status, and that there should be humane conditions. So this looks like a very nice facility. This is in Lithuania, I believe. The reason I show this is because it's a brand new gleaming detention center where they had several very problematic deaths and where the European Court of Human Rights ruled that to be detained here was tantamount to torture or uncruel punishment. And so there was a finding against this facility. There was a finding against the government based on conditions in this facility. But I guess what I want to put out there is that there are new detention centers, there are old detention centers, but that really has very little bearing on the quality of the medical care in those facilities. Having said that, this obviously is a place where people are probably not going to get very good medical care. And again, so this slide I like very much because somebody had scrawled on a wall their journey. So they had started in Mali, then they went to that middle areas in Chad, and then they were on their way to Spain. So it kind of gives you an idea, and each of these spots could be a potential detention center, right? You could be detained somewhere in Africa, you could be detained multiple places in Europe once you get there. So the EU policy has recently changed, and this is really just what I want to mention, is that there have been problems with standards at detention centers. So on the advocacy side, people have said, you know, especially in Greece and in Italy, there are some detention centers like the one I showed you, that packing crate, where people had very poor conditions. And so in the advocacy community, people have been pushing for standards, right? Some of the stuff we just talked about for the United States. We want legally mandated common standards for everybody. The other push to reform immigration has had to do with, and maybe this is analogous to our country too, is the rise in anti-immigrant sentiment in many, many EU countries. I want to show you a poster from a recent Swiss campaign. So, and this is not, you know, this is not, this is a poster that was all over Switzerland during the campaign in 07, I believe. So this, I think, characterizes, crystallizes some of the thoughts. So we had this second very powerful group of forces pushing for immigration reform, including detention reform in Europe. I'm sorry. I realize I put in my hyperlink and did not use it well. So what I want to do is discuss this thing called the EU Return Directive. What does this mean? So the EU Return Directive was just passed last in 08 in the summer, and it created some standards for who can be detained and how long they can be detained. So these are what are called irregular migrants. We would call undocumented immigrants or illegal aliens, depending on what you want to say. So what it said is everybody, all EU countries that are signatories, you can detain people for up to 18 months. So it's basically 6 months, and then if you're in the middle of administrative processes or asylum applications, you can detain people for an extra 12 months. So 18 months total. And then there were some standards put in for conditions of detention. So the EU Return Directive, which everybody but the UK has signed and is part of, just put in like one little blurb saying you need to get emergency health care and then essential treatment of other medical problems. So from a medical standpoint, it's nice to have this in there, but there's no infrastructure that's created for oversight. There's nobody, this document doesn't say what's essential treatment. So that's the million-dollar question is hypertension treatment essential treatment? Is a pap smear essential treatment? Is mammography, health screening? We just don't know. So I wanted to break down what things were like before the EU Return Directive was signed. So there were some countries at the top that had the possibility for unlimited detention. So the UK, those countries there at the top. So those countries could theoretically detain people forever, or as years and years, as long as their case was going on. So for those countries, people in those countries will be detained potentially for less time, because the new EU Return Directive says up to 18 months. I put a star next to the UK because they've opted out of this, so they're not currently part of the EU Return Directive. So up to 12 months, and you see all the subsequent groups, up to 12 months, up to 3 months, up to 1 month, people in those countries now can be potentially detained for longer periods of time, because now the ceiling is set at 18 months. So what this means is for people in all of these countries in those second, third, and fourth categories, the potential is to be detained for longer than was previously the case. Final thing I want to mention is an institution called Frontex. Has anybody heard of Frontex? So this is kind of like Europe's version of ICE, except, so this is an EU agency with a directive to manage and manage border patrols and border activities that involve detention and screening of irregular migrants is the terminology they use. So it's just been around for a couple of years. They don't run detention centers themselves. They do some detaining, and they interact closely with, it's I guess also analogous to Interpol, interacts with police departments locally. So Frontex interacts with local detaining authorities. So some of the concerns that advocacy groups in Europe have come up with, one is that there's been some thought that rescue work, so for instance, people coming over from Africa, North Africa, to Europe, to Spain, to Greek islands, anywhere in that area, Frontex has very active surveillance and rescue operations, but some of these rescue operations, there have been allegations that these are really deterrence operations. And then the other thing is that there have been a number of reports by advocacy groups in Europe that Frontex is actively discouraging people from making asylum claims, so that if people come into contact with a Frontex agent and say, I'd like to request asylum, can you direct me where to go? They'll be told, we don't do that, that's not our job, we don't know where you should go with this. And I'm putting these out here because there's a real lack of, because this is a new agency, and because it operates in many, many different countries, there's a real lack of information about how they operate. These are some concerns, but I would say that I can't credibly tell you that these concerns, A, are valid, or that they're widespread or rare, but these are the concerns that advocacy groups have voiced. So that's all I wanted to say. I just want to give a quick blurb about detention in Europe. And really what I'd like to do is open things up for us. We have, I believe, 15 minutes where we can kind of discuss and ask questions of each other. So let's go ahead and do that. Yeah.
I want to take a deep cleansing breath in response to some of what I've heard. I appreciate the presence of this workshop and this discussion topic at APHA. That's one thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say, just by way of observation, is it seems that in some ways, when I hear conversations about making improvements on some of these structures and systems, using management techniques and so forth, what it feels like to me is improving slave quarters, when what we really need to do is abolish slavery. Now, I did hear people's question, why are we criminalizing and why are we incarcerating? But I also hear about improvements, and I think that it's very difficult to make cosmetic improvements on a system without looking at what are the driving forces between the triggers for human migration in this world right now, which are largely globalization and also just in tremendous disparities in people, where people had been in countries where they could at least have a subsistence living, and now they cannot feed their families. Recognizing that the causes of human migration are very complex, but there's certainly also extraordinary barriers in our own system that prevent the reunification of families, all those things that those of us in public health would say, that there's certain values that drive us. And so, these issues are extremely controversial, but I guess I have to say, I want to say I am troubled by a placement of these issues in a moral context that looks at the causes of globalization and the global causes of human migration. I don't know, I could go on and comment about a lot of things. I've had a lot of direct experience. I do have conversations with people in ICE and so forth, but when you have this system that we say is not criminalized, but you have, the detainee is the non-criminal detainee has the worst of both worlds. You don't have the access to legal representation that, even some of the worst domestic child molesters have, and yet you're being deprived of your liberty. That seems to me a huge issue, and I don't care where in the world the detention happens, it seems to me that's a fundamental violation of human rights. So
that's an interesting point, if I could just, because yeah. You kind of came full circle there in a really interesting way that we all do internally, and I think when we've had these discussions, is that, I'll start where you ended, which is this guarantee of care and services that people who are convicted and arrested. So one starting point is, should we at least have that standard for people who are detained, right? Should we at least have the same standard of a legal guarantee for medical care, right? So that's one, and that's where a lot of our advocacy starts. I think it is, it's a vexing problem to discuss the policy issue, should we detain people or not. I would argue that improving medical care has to include shrinking this system. And so then what it means is if you want to advocate for medical care, you can advocate for some of the technical, operational improvements that I think are worthwhile and are important. But I also think that, you know, you can be active on the side of advocating for less detention or no detention. So I wouldn't, I guess I wouldn't discredit the efforts of anybody in one direction if, because we all have struggled with this. We had a seminar where we invited like 30 groups to NYU to talk about detainee healthcare, and we had the same discussion. We have it every time we discuss this. I would make the point, and others can answer this, but I would make the point that we have a huge system right now that is detaining a lot of people that doesn't have the same level of standards and practices for ensuring medical care that we have for our criminal arrestee population. So, at a bare minimum, we need to get that standard up to that level.
I agree with everything that you said, and I would like to offer that both at the federal level and at the local level, there are some things that we can do about shrinking this problem. First of all, once the whole healthcare passage or non-passage gets through, the next big thing is going to be immigration reform, and I think we should all be active as a public health people. We should all be working very hard to get comprehensive, just immigration reform. I personally believe that migration is a human right, and I think that with NAFTA and other such trade agreements and the dumping of subsidized U.S. corn in Mexico, et cetera, we have people who are starving, people who can't feed their families, people who are coming here, and we're going to have a big backlash on the part of people who are so concerned lest white people become a minority, which we will be. Sooner or later in this country, and that's perfectly fine. And a lot of people are upset about it, however, and the fight was for that reason, a very racist reason. So I think there's ample room for advocacy at the federal level. I also think there are things we can do at the local level. Ms. Gibson mentioned the Secure Communities Program. A big problem with that is we all want felons out of our communities, but people are taken to the local jails for things like broken taillights, for things like not being able to get a driver's license. I'm from North Carolina. You cannot get a driver's license in North Carolina unless you have a Social Security card. One thing that we can do.
But just to be clear, though, under the Secure Communities Program, the Detention and Removal Office does not necessarily go pick that person up if it's not in line with our priorities, and our priorities are level one offenders, which are the people who've been convicted of rape, murder. So you're right, anyone can be taken and booked for any reason under the sun, but.
So you're saying that if someone is taken in and fingerprinted for not having a driver's license, for example, that.
I'm saying that they would not be specifically under our agreement with that booking jurisdiction and that location. Those people would be very, very low on our priority list, and chances are we may not even be picking them up.
One of the issues with that is that, particularly in the Southeast, many state and local law enforcement agencies have what are known as 287G agreements,
yeah,
for the provision of the Immigration Nationality Act that they're under. And under those agreements, state and local police, if they pick you up for a broken tail, like can and do turn people over regularly to ICE, and that's actually responsible for a fair amount of the growth in immigration detention,
yes,
in,
yes,
Mississippi, Louisiana,
and parts of North Carolina.
So ICE may have its own set of priorities about who they'd like to be detained, but then.
So we decide who we detain, and we just redid the MOUs with all the 287G partners and built in the same priorities there that are in the 287G agreements. And we took the task force power away from some jurisdictions so that they no longer can exercise our immigration authority on the street. Some people still have it, but those are the jurisdictions that are doing, looking at gangs. Even before you make an arrest, you have to call ICE, and we have to show the laws with their priorities. And there's very clear language in MOUs that are available.
So one of the things I wanted to ask for people's feedback on is this: is the remaking of detention centers themselves? So the idea that, you know, the ICE has put out, I think, the RFPs or certainly the intro letters for the RFPs for a couple of new, different looking detention centers that meet, that are not like maximum or medium security facilities. So has anybody either had interaction with folks who might, I guess, do people have like thoughts about like what those facilities should look like, or whether or not we can grow and change most of our facilities over to be these kind of kinder, gentler detention centers, or?
Well,
yeah.
I'm not going to answer that question. There's somebody has the answer. Go ahead. I just want to respond to the nature of this discussion to point out, for example, my own case. I've been working with prison companies for a long time, and that has made me more and more an abolitionist advocate in terms of reducing the population in prison. I think, you know, we see the same thing here when we think about the conditions that people are living under. And I think the point that was made that there's going to be, I think about 365,000 more people are going to be in these centers because within the next 2 years, because of legislation that ICE has to respond to, just like your local jail, your local, you know, your state prison system does. So thinking about those things and thinking about APHA and public health, what I come to think about is that we should try also to raise the consciousness in the American Public Health Association about this as a public health issue in terms of advocacy at the federal level through the APHA office to address the question of what happens to immigrants in detention and so on and so forth, as well as there are clearly things that can be done locally. I live in San Francisco. Recently there was a struggle in the San Francisco Board of Supervisors about whether juveniles who were arrested immigrants would be, you know, referred or not be referred, et cetera. But I just want to emphasize something that could come out of this workshop, and that is to do some more advocacy in the direction of APHA. Think about this whole issue as a public health issue. And maybe we'll get over to lead this.
Well, I mean, I think that that's,
I'd
say that's the reason we're here is like that I and others have sporadically given little talks here and there on detention health here and other medical society meetings. But, you know, I think of this as like back to the 70s when Estelle v. Gamble, the Supreme Court case was decided, where all of a sudden like the AMA came in and the APHA came in, and like multiple groups of people became involved who had expertise in operational areas, but also expertise in some of these broad human rights concerns, and got involved in this issue. And I think that I also heed the call of, you know, ICE, because they're looking for people who have like certain areas of expertise to do not all, but some of the things we were just saying they need to do. So it's on us in the community, advocacy community, and academic community to get involved. I see we're just about done. Does anybody have like one comment or question they want to wrap up with? Alan?
Well, I don't necessarily, maybe others think this is wrong. I don't think it's contradictory. One is to question the paradigm, and that does happen at the federal and at the legislative issue. I think, as was pointed out by my colleague from DHS, they're enforcing legislation that was passed by our elected officials. So clearly, key advocacy for APHA and others is to question this, and that if we are going to have a revision of immigration reform, what does that look like? And I think sort of the question of should we be detaining, should we be calling, quote, illegal this many individuals? That's a question that has profound public health implications. On the other side, I do view it as it's a reality that there's a substantial number of individuals, and perhaps an even growing number, that are detained. And so what can we do to improve the conditions? I do start from a place of a gilded cage is a gilded cage, or a cage. But that they're clearly, from these cases, from studies such as ours, important lessons of decreasing morbidity and mortality for those who are detained. But I think it will all come, you know, it does come back to questioning, you know, who is there. But I, you know, again, remain optimistic that, yeah, as we've had a healthcare reform, maybe we will have a meeting somewhere in the middle of what immigration reform looks like. And I also remain optimistic that of a real commitment for those in immigration detention, that we will see some substantive improvements as well. But I don't necessarily view it as a contradiction of you know, of that trying to improve the conditions of confinement. And I think, yeah, starting from that standard of Estelle v. Gamble, that if you are held in you know, in prison, you deserve access to decent medical care, I think is an important thing.
Yeah,
but
can I make a final thought just to show the real complexity of some of this? For people who say, why do we detain? And we recently had in Somalia that the Supreme Court decision said we require to release them. We released them on a bracelet that was GPS accessibility. We pretty much know where he was detaining him. You know, that's as high an alternative to detention as you can get. And he murdered a man recently in Minnesota. And that the family of that victim has, you know, equally strong views about whether we should detain or not detain. And I don't set that up to say that aliens are dangerous or murderers or anything else, but I put it out there to show just the really, really difficult issues that ICE deals with day in and day out, and the real extreme side we can face attack from, and that we're trying to get it right for the aliens and for the community, and it's not an easy balance.
Did he have a felony conviction before, or did he just happen to be?
He did, and we were not. The Supreme Court rules required, you know, since you adopted us, you can only detain someone for so long, so we're required to release him, and he did have a felony conviction.
I really do distinguish. It seems like there should be more.
Yeah, so sorry, I hate to close it off, but we've got to go to other sessions. But I just want to say thank you to everybody, especially to our colleagues from DHS. And I think that Nancy's comments about us as public health people sticking our nose and learning about this issue is well taken. So thank you all.